You are listening to the Massive Report podcast.
This is a little different version of the Massive Report podcast than you're used to. Obviously, with everything going on with the coronavirus and no sports, there's not a ton of, reason for us to do a weekly normal podcast. We don't have crew games to talk about or news that's coming out. So we're going to try something a little different. And I'm Patrick Murphy. I'm here with Sam Fahmy today. And we're going to do a little kind of back and forth, ask some questions, kind of explaining a little bit about how we got involved with the crew, both as fans and then on the media side of things. Maybe tell some stories that people may not know, and whatnot, and just kind of do something different. And the plan here is we'll have, people hopefully each week that have contributed with Massive Report or, you know, have some kind of connection that we'll bring on, and we'll ask them some questions and try and get some stories and just have some unique crew content. That's, you know, the best we can do right now while we don't have any soccer to actually talk about. And hopefully we don't end up getting very far because we're back and the team's back and all that. But in the case that doesn't, we're trying out something different. So in case you don't know, if you just listen to the podcast or you are new to the podcast, Sam is our producer and he chimes in from time to time. But usually he's behind the scenes. And then he also, if you're not familiar with the website, massreport.com, him and Ralph are photographers and they do a great job. And so a lot of the photos you see on the site, whether it's, you know, on our stories or stuff on Twitter, comes from Sam or Ralph. So Sam, the first thing to kind of get going, what initially drew you, let's go way back, I guess, what initially drew you to soccer in general? Why, before we even get into crew stuff, why soccer?
If you know absolutely nothing about me, let's start with this. I was born and raised in Egypt. Much like the rest of the world, soccer is the primary sport. So I've been probably playing or watching soccer since I was maybe about, 5 or 6. And it's not the same as, organized academies and playing in school or playing in high school or anything like that. You put a whole bunch of socks together and you go out in the street and you play and you try not to get hit by cars. And, that's so good. Yeah, soccer is a way of life. And teams are, people are very passionate about the teams, which my team is El Ahly. If you know anything about African soccer, we are basically the kings of Africa.
When did you move here? I don't know if I even know this, actually.
Yeah, that's a bit of a tricky question, but I moved here permanently in the beginning of 97 for college, the spring of 97, yeah.
Was that Columbus or just the United States?
No, it was Cincinnati, actually.
Okay. And so at what point did you start following the crew and what was kind of the driving force behind that?
I started following the crew, the first game I ever attended was in 98, maybe, or maybe in late 97. And it was oddly enough against DC United at the Horseshoe. Nice. And one of my friends in college was like, "Hey, there's this pro soccer game in Columbus and we're going to go, it's a 2-hour drive. Do you want to go with us?" And I'm like, "Sure. You guys have pro soccer here? I thought America didn't play soccer." So we came up to the Horseshoe and, the crew got shellacked, I believe 3-0 that day, and it was raining and it was awful. And I honestly didn't like the style of play, the different MLS rules at that time. all of those crazy things were a really major turnoff. And I didn't really care much for, soccer or American soccer and MLS in general. Of course, no satellite, no cable TV on campus at that time on our campus. So really there wasn't much of a choice outside of playing, you know, video game soccer to kind of keep that passion running.
Yeah, it's funny. The league's obviously evolved so much since back then that, you know, so many new fans, not just in Columbus, but, you know, around the country. Mm-hmm. I think that how the league was originally, formatted and the rules that it had, I imagine there's a lot of fans out there that don't even know, you know, like the old penalty kick shootout where you start at midfield and run up. And yeah, it was interesting. So,
hockey style.
Yeah, hockey style. Yeah, exactly. It was interesting. So my story's somewhat similar to yours. I grew up playing soccer, and I lived in St. Louis until I was about 10. And my dad moved here a couple of years before then, before my sister and I ended up moving here. He got married to a woman he'd known from well before then. They reconnected, and she was here. She was from St. Louis also, but had gone to Ohio State Law School after she went to Denison. And so my dad moved here, I want to say, right around the time the team first started, because I remember them going to the first game, and I was still in school in St. Louis. And St. Louis, for people who don't know, is huge into soccer. And I'm excited that they're getting an MLS team, though they have historically not supported professional teams well, unless you're the St. Louis Cardinals in baseball. But so we'll see how that goes. But in terms of playing soccer, I mean, you know, there's a long list of MLS players that have come from St. Louis. Brian McBride, he's not from there, but he played college there. Taylor Twellman, Steve Ralston, even recently Josh Sargent is a St. Louis boy. There's still a bunch of them in the league. But so I grew up, you know, it was around the Rams were, you know, the football team in town, and the Cardinals obviously with baseball, but soccer was a big deal in terms of what you played. I went to a Catholic school until I moved to Columbus, and that was the only sport that they offered. And it was co-ed K through eighth grade, and each grade had its own team. So that was what we did. Yeah, and it was fun. Looking back, it's crazy to think at that age group you're playing co-ed. You know, like, I don't know if it was full field, but at the time it felt full field. It was just, you know, the Catholic elementary school league, I guess, around the city. So I remember when the league started, and I remember my dad being really excited about it. But my sister and I were still in St. Louis, and eventually we moved here, like I said. But during the summers, we would do like 2 weeks in St. Louis, 2 weeks in Columbus, 2 weeks in St. Louis, 2 weeks in Columbus. So we were here quite a bit, and I don't think we had season tickets the first year. But my dad definitely got season tickets the second year, and we, you know, eventually became very, very regular attendees. And my dad and my stepmom went a lot, and so I can't tell you for sure what my first game was. I was just too young to remember. But I do remember, you know, the first time. I do remember going to Ohio Stadium, because I didn't even go to an Ohio State football game until well after I lived here. So Ohio Stadium to me was a huge soccer stadium until I learned otherwise. But it was definitely an interesting experience. In St. Louis, they had the Ambush, which was a indoor team. So I'd gone to some of those games, but seeing professional soccer in a live outdoor was a crazy thing. And, you know, now I think so many people are so used to it, especially kids now that live in MLS cities. They grow up with a team around them, and you know, that just wasn't the case in America, and not anything of quality especially. So it was a weird time. The league was very much still trying to figure itself out, I think, and you know, obviously it's worked thus far, and they've kind of gotten in line with the rules of the rest of the world. But those days were crazy.
Yeah, they were definitely interesting. I remember the DC contingent was maybe like all of 20 people, and they brought drums and they were like rowdy. And I remember half of them getting arrested for smuggling liquor into Ohio Stadium.
Nice.
Yes, it was. It was like that was my first experience of the DC crew rivalry.
Well, and even MLS, you know, even as it's evolved, I remember when Dallas opened what was originally Pizza Hut Park. Like they opened it, but it wasn't.
I totally forgot that it was called Pizza Hut Park.
Yeah, it was.
Wow.
And they, like, it wasn't finished completely, or part of it. They had more plans to. I don't know if it wasn't finished, but like the locker rooms were just trailers on the outside of the stadium initially. Like maybe for the first year or so, while they got every training rooms, and so like even as you know, that was probably you know. So Mafre opened in 98. It was the Home Depot Center was a couple years later, I want to say, maybe 2001. And then that's when it kind of started to take steps and teams are really starting to do it. So I would imagine Pizza Hut Park was probably 2001, 2002, 2003, somewhere in there. I guess we could look this up. Some of these stadiums just still didn't have, I mean, you know, look at Mafre Stadium in comparison with with other stadiums in MLS now. And obviously that was a weird situation because of how, you know, they had to get it, you know, up and running very quickly given the situation with Ohio Stadium and the renovations. But looks like it opened in 2005.
Oh, wow.
So a little bit later than I thought. But it was a different league, and you know, I for people that weren't fans then, I thought the coolest thing about MLS back then was that, you know, every team still played each other. It was small enough that, you know, I mean, at one point it was, I think it got up to 12 teams with the Fire and the Fusion, and then they subtracted, and those were in 98, I want to say, and then after 2001, I think, I'm doing this off the top of my head, they got rid of both the Florida teams, Tampa Bay and Miami. So you're down to 10 teams, and they'd gone to three divisions, I think. The Central Division was a thing for a while.
Oh, yeah.
And they cut that and went back to two. But so you got to see teams every year. I mean, maybe they don't come to Columbus, but you know, now, I mean, the Crew this year, assuming they end up playing a full season, aren't going to play any of the California teams. And I think every team has three teams they don't play. So – you know, you kind of miss out on that stuff. And the heyday, I think, of me, like, watching MLS as a fan, and you can tell me when it was for you, was, like, right around 2000, 2001, 2002. Actually, I guess it went a little bit longer because they just had the 2005 MLS Cup on. MLS has been streaming those on YouTube, like, classic games. And I was like, I remember this vividly, watching these old games. It wasn't great soccer, but, you know, the likes of Taylor Twellman and Brian Ching and, you know, Alejandro Moreno on Houston, which I completely forgot he played for Houston. But yeah, those were kind of the heyday of, like, I remember I used to DVR games and just every day when I'd come home from school while I was doing my homework, just throw on whichever game I hadn't watched yet throughout the week and whatnot.
That really explains a lot.
Yeah.
I actually never really had that window of fandom. Let's see. I finished college in 02 in Cincinnati. And then Abby and I moved up here in 03. My following of the Crew from Cincinnati outside of like whatever is in the newspaper was very limited. I still didn't really care for American professional soccer. I was playing, you know, indoor three times a week, in various leagues on campus and off campus. So then when we moved up here to Columbus, I'm like, okay, well, they're here, might as well, you know, support the local team. And we weren't in a position to like go to a lot of games, so yeah. I might have made it to like a game or two here and there, but like the play style, I mean, we're talking 03-04, it was not great. No. I remember when they won the Supporters Shield in 02. And I'm like, and it was like
Open Cup.
Open Cup in 02. When was the Supporters Shield?
That was like 04? 4-5 probably with Greg Andrulis, you mean?
With Andrulis when they tied like just about every game in, right. in some weird fashion, and they won the Supporters Shield. You know, and then I was there for the playoff game in 2007 against New England.
That sounds right.
When Dante Washington, they brought Dante Washington out of retirement, right. and they had to win by like one goal, and they could not do it. And it was just like it had to be one of the more frustrating games I've ever seen. I remember sitting up in the 200 section, like right at center field, and at that time I was a referee. I was doing like rec league refereeing, so by our referee code of conduct, you couldn't yell at other referees. So I had to show restraint, but I was so mad. I was so angry, and it, you know, and we'll talk about this further down, but that. My window of experience as a fan of the Crew itself was very, very, very short. And even how I got involved in what I'm doing now is its own story.
Yeah, 2004, they finished 12-5-13 with 49 points.
Yeah.
Tied with Kansas City, who was 14-9-7. They must have had the tiebreaker because they won the Supporters Shield that year.
Yep.
And then they lost in the quarterfinals of the playoffs and subsequently didn't qualify for the playoffs the next three seasons. So,
yep.
That was and then obviously the year that they did qualify, they won the Supporters Shield again and the MLS Cup. So,
yep.
You kind of led into it there, but you've been around Mass Report for quite some time. How did you get involved and kind of the formation of it, because I know it's been through a few iterations to get to what we do today with SB Nation and whatnot. So for people that haven't been around the site as long as you have, give some background information on that and then how you got involved.
Yeah. So I actually have to, I'm going to flip those around because really one led to the other. I was not involved in Massive Report first. And actually, my involvement, how I came to be involved with the Crew as a whole, was kind of really a sequence of events that even I myself wasn't expecting. I was working at a bank. I'm not shooting sports. I've just gotten my first digital camera the year before. I still like soccer, of course, but I'm doing portraits, senior shoots, family shoots, things like that. Just getting into digital photography, really. And I am sitting at work on my lunch break, and I'm reading the sports section. And as I'm reading the sports section, I read about the Crew home opener, which I didn't even know it was coming around. I didn't know the season started that early because, you know, I'm thinking in European terms where the season doesn't start to like August. And I see
they've always been good at the marketing of things.
Yeah, right. And I see this headline about, you know, rivalry with Toronto fans, and I'm like, what? Toronto has a team? And why does it play in American soccer? And, you know, it's one of those weird things. But I see this guy quoted in the newspaper. You listeners may know him. His name is Blake Compton from at that time Hudson Street Hooligans. And which Hudson Street Hooligans is still around, I believe.
Yeah.
I think so. And I'm like, Blake Compton, I know that name. Why do I know that name? And I have to think about it for a second. I'm like, wait a minute. That's my wife's cousin.
Oh.
So, yeah. So I text Abby and I'm like, hey, isn't Blake your cousin? She was like, yeah. I'm like, oh, okay. Interesting. He's quoted in the newspaper. To me, that's fascinating. It's not every day that you see somebody you know quoted in the newspaper back then. Right. That's not the case anymore. So I said, I was like, oh, huh. I see that the home opener is coming up, and it sounds like it would be a good game. Well, I'm going to just, you know, see if I can get tickets, and maybe I'll take my camera, and if I can get in with my camera, even if this completely sucks and nothing else, I'll at least know somebody there. Because I know Blake and Blake knows me. So I'm like, all right. So I go in, I easily purchase a ticket to the home opener against Toronto.
Right.
Go
this
in.
This was 09?
This was 08.
Oh, okay. Oh, okay.
Yeah, yeah. And go in to, they didn't stop me with my camera. At that time, it wasn't anything big. It was just, you know, a real basic thing. And I'm like, all right, well, this is going to be interesting. So I walk around, find a nice spot, and I just start taking pictures. I find Blake and I say hi to him, and I'm introduced to several other people who I'm now good friends with. People like Smitty were some of the people that I've met, or T-Bone, Jonathan, whichever yeah. way you want to call him.
Whatever name.
We're one of the first people I met in that game. I remember, you know, it was just, you know, it was fascinating. I'm like, wow, this is really cool. Like the supporters section had kicked in. I remember yeah. The pre-stage time and the stage. And I'm like, I didn't really like the stage very much. And I'm like, this is just really weird for me. But yeah, so I started taking pictures. I edited them after the game, the crew won. And, I looked up a couple of, crew supporters blogs, and I sent them the pictures. I'm like, hey, I happened to be at the game. I was taking some pictures. I hope, you know, if you guys like them, you can use them. And, you know, it kind of picked up from there. And I was like, they're like, are you going to shoot every game? And I'm like, well, I don't really know if I can afford to come to every game, but I'll try, as long as I can, you know, continue to bring in my camera. So Crew Union's blog at that time picked it up and they were posting them. Ryan at Crewcher picked it up and he was posting them all the time. It was like, okay, this is cool. This is, you know, I'm understanding things. I'm getting better at shooting sports. I've never shot sports before. So this was my trial and error part. And, halfway, I believe through the season, I was at the front of 101, right in the walkway, and I was taking pictures, and this guy in a suit comes up to me, and he was like, are you the guy who's taking pictures for the supporters?
I think I see where this is going.
Yeah, and I panicked for a second, and I'm like, yes, is that okay? He was like, oh, no, it's fine. He was like, your pictures are pretty good, but why are you in the stands? And I'm like, well, I just buy a ticket to come in. I'm not shooting for anybody. I'm just shooting for myself, and I don't really have any way of getting down there. So he hands me his card, and he goes like, send me an email. I'm going to get you on the field. And I'm like, okay. Well, this escalated quickly, and I wasn't really expecting that. That fine man was Chris Keeney, who was VP of marketing at that point, or VP of fan relationships or something okay. like that.
I thought you were going to say it was Patrick.
There's a story for how I met Patrick. That was before I met Patrick. That was before I met a bunch of other people that were involved at Massive Report too. So, I emailed Chris. Chris connected me with Dave Stephanie, who was the communications manager at that time. And, I basically shot the rest of the season from field level, which let me tell you, my soccer experience and from my part of the world, I had never expected, I have never been to a pro game for my favorite team. I have never entered a stadium in Egypt to watch a professional game. So to be on the field in a professional game, in the U.S. was a very, very different experience for me. And yeah. It was very, it was a very unnerving experience. Eventually it got more comfortable, and a lot of the guys in the 08 team had a strong hand in that. And that's why all of them hold a very, very special, dear place in my heart. Communication and the things that I've learned from people like Greg Bartram, who was the team photographer at that time and who still shoots the crew, and who, you know, other people that I've met that basically kind of took me under their wing and kind of guided me in figuring out how to be a professional sports photographer. There's a lot of do's and don'ts, and they were very patient, very kind and gracious. So after that, I shot the rest of the season from down there, and the only game I missed, I couldn't go to California to shoot the MLS Cup. But I was there for the beatdown on Chicago in the everybody's favorite game, the Eastern Conference Final in 08. I was there for supporter shield ceremonies. Lots and lots of events since that point. We didn't start Massive Report until 2010.
Right.
Yeah, 2010. And that was a very big turning point, and there's definitely a story there.
That's funny, because like my experience was rather different, just because like this was something I was trying to do as, you know, for a living, which took quite a while, the whole other story. But you know, shortly after I got out of college, you know, I was a Crew fan. I'd been going to games. You know, I went when my dad had season tickets, my family had season tickets, I guess I should say. We went, and then towards the end of high school, I started going, not on my own, but we'd go and sit down in the North End. I had a buddy, my buddy Nick, and our friend Julia, both went to high school with me, would go down there, and Nick's a big Arsenal fan, and just like fell in love with the supporters culture of you know, and wanted to be a part of that, and wanted to make banners, and you know, all this stuff. And you know, we're high school kids, so we don't really know what we're doing. And Julia was a soccer fan, and I don't even really remember how we all started going to games together, but my dad would take us, and eventually it became a thing that a group of us went. And you know, I'd met through going and sitting down there, you know, people like Mike Sad, you know, Mike Hard Hat Mike, what's his last name?
Blakely.
Blakely, that's it. He was just in our tattoo story, and a bunch of people, Christina Bolevska. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm gonna forget people, but you know, all of the old V Army guys, basically. That, you know, at first they were very, you know, what are these high school kids doing there? They were in college at the time, and you know, drinking and whatnot. And we were just kind of there. And eventually, when we had more people, we started. this is somewhat embarrassing. We started our own like high school little supporter section, which we called Legion 04. I think 04 was because I don't know actually why. I think Nick came up with the name, but so we did that for a while, and then eventually we actually had a decent amount of people coming out. You know, it was something to do that was different during the summer on a Saturday night. And then when we got to college, which was, I started college in 2007. So that first summer, That first summer was the 2008 season. And what it became for a lot of my friends that went, and I went to Denison my freshman year. So at the beginning of the season, I was driving back. There were only a few games before the season ended, but I was driving back to go, and I had a couple friends at Denison who were soccer people that would come back to me. But eventually that summer, it became a place for people to go and drink. Like, we had a bunch of people to go, and at that point, as you talked about, the stage had been built. And for 1 year, they had like separate supporter sections, but then the Nordic kind of became its own thing when the stage was built. And that was kind of what brought everything together in terms of the Nordic. And so we had a bunch of people that would show up mostly because they wanted a place to drink on a Saturday night where they weren't going to be bothered by police officers, because there were so few of them in the Mafra Stadium parking lot. But we had a good group that used to come out. One of my friends used to bring a grill, and we would do our own little mini tailgate thing. So that was kind of how I did games throughout college. And I once stormed out of a game against the Chicago Fire because I was so mad at how they were playing. And in 08, I was going, we went to the Eastern Conference Final. They obviously won. And as we're leaving, I'm walking out with Nick, and he's like, we have to go to MLS Cup. And I was like, there's no way I can go to MLS Cup. You know, I'm a freshman in college. I was just about to start working as soccer retail up in Westerville. I don't know if I'd even started then. And like, I just had no money. And I was like, there's no way that I can afford that. He was like, we got to go. We'll figure it out. You'll regret it if you don't. And I was just like, no, like I can't, I literally can't do this. So the next day, the game was being replayed and I'm watching it. And Nick's texting me like, I just bought my ticket, you know, my plane ticket or whatever. And I was like, I still can't do this. So the Eastern Conference final finishes and I'm just like, I have to do this. And so I had a credit card, which was, I think was like, when, you know, if you overdraw your account, it's like overdraft.
Oh, protection. Yeah.
I think that's what it was for. And I don't think I'd ever used it to actually purchase anything. And so I go online and in the time I'd like waffled back and forth, the same plane ticket Nick had gotten had gone up like $200. So I just put on my credit card and was like, I'll figure it out later. And so Nick and I went to the Ohio State Michigan game that next weekend, I guess, on Saturday. And we sat separately. And then we met at my apartment. His parents picked us up, drove us to the airport. And right after they picked us up, Nick's parents are kind of hippies. And they were like, look under your seat. And we each had, they had a bottle of beer for each of us under the seat. And they're like, you got to finish it before you get to the airport. Oh, okay. And then we had, I mentioned Mike Satt earlier, he got us alcohol for the tailgate, which was unnecessary in retrospect. There was plenty of alcohol available. And we went to the game. We stayed with our friend Julia, went to UCLA, so we stayed with her. And it was crazy because we went from freezing cold at the Ohio State Michigan game to being like sweltering hot. And I have a long sleeve Kyle Martino jersey that Kyle actually gave to me.
I've seen you wear it before.
Yeah, it's it was from the year that they lost in penalty kicks. I guess it was that New England year when Tony Sane missed the penalty kick.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. And I'd worn that all season, like through the summer. It's not, I mean, it's long sleeved and it's black, so it gets hot, but it's
it
was a legit jersey, so it's pretty breathable. But yeah, wearing that in LA was rather warm. But yeah, and then after the game, and anyone who was out there would know this, after the game, people were trying to figure out like what to do. Obviously, people want to go out and celebrate. Well, we're, you know, 19 years old, so a lot of the people are planning on going to bars or this, that. So we're trying to figure it out. And Julia knows some people at UCLA, but she hasn't been there that long to know a bunch of party, you know, like we want to be with crew people. So we end up hearing that they're going to allow crew fans into the post or into the party for the team and their families once dinner is done at the team hotel. And so I don't even know how we got over there. Somehow we got over there and we were like, we don't know if this is true. Like somebody had told us this. So it turns out it was true. And we'd met like a couple of cruisers, which were crew cheerleaders for people who don't go back that far,
right?
On the plane. And actually, that was the plane was when I first met Robbie Rovick, who's one of my favorite people in the world. And so we were hanging out with them, and I ended up sitting at a table with Ziggy's high school soccer teammates, like a handful of them. And they're like telling me all these crazy stories about Ziggy in college and like keg stands and then him as a soccer player. And I'm trying to picture like the Ziggy I'm like looking at across the room, A, as a soccer player, and B, doing keg stands. But it was crazy. And Drew Van Runkel, who used to be at every crew related event and was a crazy, crazy human.
Now he is he's a crazy, crazy human still.
Well, he's married and has a child now. So it's
that has not stopped it.
It's changed it because he was nuts. But he came up to us and because we still weren't 21 and there was a bar, but you had to, you know, show ID. He was like, hey, I've got a bottle of Jaeger in my room unopened. He's like, I've been here since Wednesday drinking and my liver can't take it anymore. Like, you guys want the bottle of Jaeger? Like, I can't take it back with me on the plane. So we're walking around this like fancy party in crew gear with a bottle of Jaeger, just like drinking straight out of added at. So yeah. So that was a long story about all of that, but that was one of my favorite memories as like a Crew fan. And then once I got done with college, I took some time to try and like make sure this was really what I wanted to do. And I figured out that it was the you know, journalism side of things. And I'd covered the Crew a little bit in college for the Lantern, but with the way, you know, they don't publish as often during the summer, and with the way the school year works, it's kind of the beginning and the end of the season. So I'd covered a little bit of the Robert Varzeja era. And actually I went out to practice for the first time, and I was doing a story on Danny O'Rourke. And I knew Danny from a guy that I worked with, had graduated the same year as him, and they were both soccer players. And so I'd met him a couple times. So he's walking off the practice field and he sees me. So I just like walk up to him and we do the interview and everything went fine. And then the PR guy at the time came up and was like, "Hey, it's clear that was fine with him, but like, this isn't how we do things." And I was like, "Oh, that makes sense. I should probably, you know, ask permission," or, you know, whatever the situation was. But so I was looking for a way to get, after college, to get experience and, you know, help build a resume. And I reached out to Patrick and I was trying to find it, but I think, you know, he was, you know, welcoming of somebody to help write. But I think the first thing I wrote was an Eddie Gavin story. I'm sure if I dug back deep enough, I could find it, but I want to say that was the end of the either 2012 or 2013 season.
I think that sounds about right.
Yeah. And so it was the next year when you guys asked me about, you know, doing stuff more regularly. And I remember I was working at Soccer Plus in Westerville and I got a call from the Crew number. And I was like, it wasn't my season ticket rep. And I didn't answer it. I called back again. So I answered it. And it was Alex Caulfield and Tim Miller. And they were, and I'd met both of them. I just didn't have their work numbers. I don't know if I had their numbers at all, but they were calling to, you know, Patrick had told them or put in credential requests or whatever. But, you know, he told them that I was going to, you know, be out of practice sometimes and all this. And it was a funny conversation because they were like, you know, "We want to make sure you're going to handle this professionally. And, you know, you're not going to be coming out to practice, you know, wearing Crew gear," you know, something along those lines. They wanted to make sure I was serious about it. And I was like, "Yeah, like I've been to practice before. Like, you know, I know what I'm doing."
You remember back in those days when we used to have open practices for everybody willy-nilly to go?
Yeah. Well, and when they used to have reserve games that you could just go to out there. And yeah, but so that was the start of doing this side of things, which has certainly changed my perspective on the Crew and, you know, just sports in general. It, you know, I was a big Ohio State fan too growing up, you know, at least once I moved to Columbus and even a little bit before. But now it's certainly changed the way I look at even the teams that I'm still a fan of. I used to get unnecessarily upset. Like I said, I stormed out of Moffray Stadium one time, and now I like to think I'm a little more chill when it comes to those things. I wanted to ask you, Sam, what, if you can think of one or maybe a couple of stories that, you know, doing this, the photographing, photography, I guess is the word, that, you know, maybe that has opened opportunities that you wouldn't have gotten as just a Crew fan. Obviously you talked about shooting from the field, but maybe some, you know, things you did or games you got to shoot that were just, you know, unique or whatnot that maybe kind of stand out in your mind.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I'm going to actually circle around first and go to how Massive Report got started, because I don't think a lot of people know how that happened. I think I want to say it was like late 2009 or maybe early 2010. I got a voicemail or a text from Steve Cirque, who at that time, of course, Steve got caught on to what is, because Steve has his finger on the pulse of Crew Nation fans and players.
Oh yeah.
He really liked a lot of the pictures that I had taken, and he actually asked to use a few of them in various notebooks that he was writing. And I get a call from him, and he said, "Hey, The guy who's writing for the AP wants to start something that's very crew-centric, that's not AP-related. And I gave him your number. I think you would be a good help for what he's trying to do. And I'm like, okay, I don't know this guy. At that point, I never ever went to the press box because I have no reason to be up there. As photographers, we have our own little room. And back at that time, there was maybe like three or four of us total that photographed the team, including the team photographers. So, you know, I was like, all right. So I got a phone call from this guy. And he said, hey, look, can we meet up? Here's my idea. That guy would be our original publisher, Bob Stein, who is a professor at Columbus State, but he was also writing for the Associated Press at that time, covering the crew, and he'd been doing it for, I think, 4 or 5 years at that point. So he said, I really want to start something that's very like crew-centric, that is more like fan-based than it is like AP style, but is still, you know, pretty professional, provides good journalism, things like that. He was like, I would really like to add you as one of the people on my staff in getting this thing off the ground. And I'm like, sure, I'd love to. And he goes like, you know, do you know any other people that would be interested in joining? And I'm like, well, I have a few people that I have met in the last 2 years. Let me reach out to them. I had met people like Lamakia at if you remember in 2008, the team was kind of going through a slump and there was some infighting in the supporters groups and stuff like that. And Ziggy called for a for that meeting in upper 90 between the supporters groups and the team. And like Guillermo is there and Gino is there and Chad Marshall and Danny O'Rourke. And before that meeting, I hear somebody saying my screen name, which is Studio 79, and you're like, have you guys heard of that guy? Has anybody ever met him or whatever? And I sheepishly raised my hand, and I'm like, that's me. That's when I met Chris Lamakia. Well. Yeah, that's when I met Chris Lamakia, because he was the one, yep, in that. I met Patrick in the basement of Ruby's, which is where I've met a lot of other people. He was one of the blogs that I'd started following as I'm starting to get into, like, I know nothing about this team. I need to like learn more of what's happening, back when he used to be publishing, An American Game. He came in and introduced himself in his very, Patrick way, and was asking if he could use one of my pictures in an article that he was writing. And I was like, yeah, sure, man, that's great. But I had been following some of these random people's writings. And I'm like, I told Bob, I said, I think I might have some people for you that can help on the writing side too. So our first grouping was, myself. It was Patrick Gul'dan. It was Smitty, Jonathan T-Bone Smith, and Chris Lamakia were the writers. Soon thereafter, we added Matt Barnhart, who is a brilliant statistician / historian. If you ever need to know something about the GRU, go to massivereportdata.com. It's still active, and he still maintains that. And it has like, you can sort it in every different way, but Matt was our like nerd guy. We started Massive Report and kind of took off from there. We started the podcast a year later because Jonathan was like, how we need to start getting in this thing called podcasting. And we're like, all right. We started doing the podcast, and here we are 9 years later.
And it wasn't
320 some odd episodes.
The site was its own thing at that point. It wasn't.
It was. It was part of Bob. Bob was actually hosting it on his own server at home. All the galleries, all the podcasts for the longest time, the whole page. Bob actually coded the page himself, the website himself. So it was very It was a very built from scratch project that that we all were part of.
Yeah, that's it's crazy to think, you know, and I mean this in the best way possible, a ragtag group of fans put together something.
Yeah. That,
you know, I mean, you look at it now and what we do, you know, in terms of the number of credentials we're able to get and some of the stuff we've been able to cover, you know, even outside of the crew in terms of national team games and things like that. You know, obviously being a part of SB Nation has helped. But, you know, it's pretty crazy how it starts from that. And that's kind of the story I think a lot of people want to have when they start up, you know, something like that. You know, it's a little bit easier, obviously, to start a crew blog, especially back then, than it is, say, you know, one of the major American sports teams in the league. But, you know, it was when I first, you know, when I first emailed Patrick and you know, kind of got on board, I didn't expect, you know, a lot of things, you know, I didn't expect to be doing it this long, especially once I got a job covering Ohio State full time. I very much considered, and I remember talking with you and Patrick about this, you know, whether or not I wanted to keep it up. But it's been such a cool experience. I mean, the first year I was really doing it full time, you know, and by full time, I mean, out at practice as much as, you know, anyone outside of at that point, Adam Jardy, was 2014. So that was Greg's first year. And, you know, at the time it was, you know, they just hired, you know, a former national team guy, a guy who actually, I remember when they call, whenever they would, you know, call him in, it was like, well, this just takes away from the opportunity of Frankie to play a lot of times. And I wasn't a huge Greg Berhalter fan as a player, which I have never expressed to him, obviously, but, you know, it was interesting seeing the transition from him as like this kind of unknown guy, you know, some guys knew him as a player, to, you know, this coach that's now obviously the national team coach. And yeah. I think despite what, you know, fans may think, you know, he is very well respected around the league. You know, obviously I think there's a segment of national team fans, especially outside of Columbus, that are like, you know, what are we doing with this guy that never won anything with the crew and da da da. But, you know, I listened to Michael Parkhurst being interviewed on the BSI podcast. I listened to it recently. It was from last year. And they asked him to rank his favorite coaches at the, you know, at the professional level. And he put Greg above Tata Martino, which I thought was super interesting. And everyone I've talked to, now there's obviously examples to the contrary, Dilly Duca being one of them, which was a weird experience to cover. But you know, everyone I've talked to has nothing but great things to say about Greg. There's so many guys that, you know, love what Greg did here and what he was trying to build and all that. But getting to know him, you know, not only interviewing, but getting to know him on as much of a personal level as I think Greg lets on was super cool. You know, most people probably don't know this, in which year was it? 2016? Whenever they played Toronto in the two-leg series where they ended up losing 1-0 in Toronto, I was going to go to the game in Toronto with I was going to ride up on the fan bus and, you know, go. The plan with the bus was drive up the day of the game. The fans are going to go to the game. And then once the game's over, drive straight back. So two things that happened. The day before I was supposed to leave, or the bus was supposed to leave, I'm at practice. And Andrew Erickson, who was the dispatch writer at the time, wasn't there because he was leaving. He was flying to Toronto that day. And so I'm interviewing Greg. We get done. We're kind of chatting. And he's like, hey, you going to Toronto? And I was like, yeah, I told him my plan. And he was like, well, we've got an extra spot on the charter if you want to come. And I was like, oh, haha. And, you know, Greg walks away and I'm waiting to talk to Will. And Will comes out. We start the interview. And then I don't know what his title was, but basically Zach ran, not Stefan, Zach Cruz ran, basically handled all of their scheduling and you know, making sure guys were, you know, had tickets booked and whatnot. And
he comes after. Did you take over after Tucker?
Yes. Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
And he comes out and he's like, sorry to interrupt. He's like, but are you coming with us on the charter this afternoon? And I was like, am I? I thought Greg was kidding. And he was like, no, I don't think so. Like, he told me to come talk to you. And Will was like, do it, man. Like, what else are you going to do? And so right. I finished up with Will. I talked to Zach and he's like, do you have your passport on you? And I was like, no, I don't just generally carry my passport around when I come out to crew practice. And he's like, all right, well, if you can get home and send me a picture of that within the hour, like, I can get it to the lady at the airport. And my head is just like spinning. I'm like, what is happening? So I'm in the car on the way back. I'm trying to like figure out what I had planned that day. Call my girlfriend. I'm like, hey, this is what happened. Like, I don't know what your plan was for this evening, but like, I don't think I should pass this up. And she was like, no, like, I think this is a good opportunity, you know, and you don't have to sit on a bus for 6 hours or whatever it is to get to Toronto, yeah. 8 hours, whatever. And so I get home, I text Neil Sika, and I was like, hey, what does one wear on the charter? Because Neil and Dwight for playoff games would fly with the team. And he was like, nothing in particular. He's like, I just wouldn't look like a slob. I was like, all right. So I get, you know, I put on a jeans and a button down, I think is what I wore. I show up at the airport. There, you know, this is at the back of the airport where they have these chartered like stations.
Oh yeah.
Guys are showing up, like looking like, why is he here type of thing. And I'm just standing there like awkwardly. I go over to talk to Carlos, who's one of the communications guys. We get on the plane. And I'm sitting there and I realized I don't have a place to stay in Toronto because we were supposed to go there and back that night on the bus. And I don't know if my cell phone is going to work there. So I knew if I could get a hold of Andrew, I could potentially crash on their floor, like if desperate. So we land in Toronto. I'm freaking out the whole flight. We land in Toronto. I go up to Zach and I'm like, hey man, I don't have a hotel room. You know, I was supposed to come up and back, and he was like, oh, we'll figure it out. And gets on the bus. And I'm just like, what is this? What does that mean? Like, I'm really freaked. I'm like, am I going to just be stuck on the street? So we get to the team hotel, which was this nice downtown Toronto hotel. And I'm standing there and, Dwight Burgess walks up to me and he's like, hey, Zach told me to give you this. And it's just an envelope. And I open it and there's a hotel room key in there. I was just like, okay, well, I must be sharing a room with somebody or like crashing on a couch. I can go up. I have an entire room to myself. It's got this ridiculous view of downtown Toronto. And I was like, what happened? Like earlier this morning, I was ready to like hang out. I don't know what, do whatever that night and then get on a bus in the morning and drive to, now I'm at a hotel with the whole team and it was crazy. And the craziest part about that story though is after the game, we go and do the post-game interviews and stuff. And then Andrew went back up to the press box to finish writing. I had to go back because I was getting back on the bus with the team and we were going straight to the airport to fly back. And so I'm in the Toronto away locker room has, you like enter and there's like a little side room off to the right, which has a couple of benches. So I'm sitting in there with a couple other of the like staff people. And Higuain walks in, and I don't know why he was in there. I'm on my computer, but he's in there doing something. And this was right at the beginning of the pre-court moving the team. Like, that stuff had just come out right before the playoffs, remember.
Yeah.
And so he walks in, and he had walked past the door, like, a couple times. And I think he saw that myself and, like, Alex Steck was in there and a couple other people. So finally he just comes in and he's talking to Pipa and Pipa is just trying to talk. Like, he's frustrated because they just lost and he wants to talk. He's trying to talk to him about the game and Precourt just keeps being like, we're going to do everything we can to make sure next year is going to be great. He's like, we're going to, you know, we'll sign whoever we need. And like, there were just two separate conversations going on. And I just remember thinking to myself, like, this man has no idea. Like, you know, he's trying to sell to this guy that it's going to be great. And all Higuain wants to do is vent about what just happened and like be upset. And yeah. He clearly has no idea how you know, to handle, you know, normal human interaction, which was always my experience with Anthony. It was always nice, but, you know, so that was the craziest thing that happened to me. And I'm sure as we continue doing this, more and more stuff will come up. I've got some good Greg stories that I thought of today that, you know, we don't need to do all in one podcast, but yeah. As we talk to more people and things come up, I think I've got some good stuff, some other road trip stories that are fun.
I mean, especially when we get Patrick Gul'dan on, him and I have been on several Noron tour buses, to Chicago and Philadelphia and the like. And, we definitely have some interesting stories from that, but I'll tell you what, to kind of carry on the fact that I had never been to professional soccer games, you know, before coming to the U.S. After Black Monday, after 2010, when, you know, pretty much everybody was released, Gino and Guillermo started a soccer academy, SP Soccer Academy, which you should be familiar with. They do some great work. They had just gotten their new uniforms for like their first ever set of uniforms for SP Academy. And they're like, hey, we need to do
from Soccer Plus in Westerville.
Yeah. So they're like, Gino, I was pretty good friends with Gino. And he was like, we need to do pictures of these uniforms. And I'm like, okay. I was like, well, I have a photo studio set up in my basement. Would you guys be interested in coming and we can do it there? Well, Gino at that time lived in Westerville, which I believe he still does, or somewhere around like in this area. Right. And I'm like, okay, so Gino comes, but I open the door and there's Guillermo too. And I'm like, well, this is interesting. So my wife, who is not a soccer person, but understands the magnitude of the two people that are currently in her basement getting their pictures taken, is like, what is going on? And I'm like, I'm not even asking anymore. This is just beyond my comprehension. And then, you know, if you knew anything about Guillermo, his English was very, very limited, but he found out that I root for El Ahly. And the year before he joined the crew, Boca Juniors played El Ahly in the Club World Cup. So he, all of a sudden, his English got way better and he just could not stop talking. I was like, since you're here, I have this really great picture of you. Would it be okay if you sign it? He was like, absolutely. And he didn't just sign it. He like wrote like a whole dedication on it in Spanish, which I do not speak Spanish, but I was like, this is pretty fantastic. So my two prized crew images are that, obviously, of Guillermo, and one of my favorite images of Frankie Hayduk being Frankie Hayduk, that he also was gracious enough to autograph for me. There's a lot of stories of where and how just doing this for the crew, the people that I've met, the players that I've been, you know, honored to not just know, but know them, know their families, even photograph some of their special events. If you would have told me 20 years ago that this is what I'd be doing, I'd be like, you are absolutely insane. And I don't know where you got these silly ideas. Because that's not doing what I do now is not anything that was on my radar.
Yeah, it is nuts. I mean, you know, I cover Ohio State and obviously there's a mystique around that, but things like standing at the tunnel at Mafre Stadium 2 years ago, whenever it was, and watching Zlatan walk out of the tunnel was just like, oh my, you know, that's not a normal man. Like that's a guy who just a couple years earlier, and I'm a big Manchester United fan, had been playing for Manchester United. And so, you know, I try not to get starstruck very often, and I think I do a pretty good job of that. But that was a moment where I was like, wow. Yeah. Yeah, Wayne Rooney, same thing.
I had the same situation with David Beckham in 2008 when the one time he actually made it to Columbus. And I mean, I've been watching David Beckham since he was a kid playing for Manchester United. And I was, I wasn't starstruck as much as I was in awe that this guy that I've watched on TV from 6,000 miles away is literally 10 feet from me, you know, and that was, I think that was really big in me, like really wanting to put even that much more into what I do and how I shoot the game and the stories of which come from those images, and what that image relays, you know, for the fan. I was a fan first. I continue to be a fan first, which is probably not the best thing to do as somebody who covers a team. If you know Patrick Murphy, you'll know why this is funny. But, you know, it's there are things that I'm like, hey, this was never in my radar, but there was a lot of things that, a lot of doors, a lot of people that were gracious enough to open doors that I was not expecting.
Yeah, well, we've gone longer than I expected, but I'm going to wrap up just because you brought up Beckham and you were just talking about Gino Padula. I met Gino because I was working at the soccer store, and like you said, they had they were getting ready to do – well, first, he would come in there with his kids was the, when I first met him. Mm-hmm. And cute kids, very cute kids. But then they were starting up this academy, and, you know, that obviously took a lot of planning. So they were, you know, throughout the 2008 season or whichever season it was when Beckham played in Columbus – throughout that season, they were in the store a lot, or at least Gino was. And so I got to know Gino pretty well. And that game, we had a couple friends in college who really, these were females, who really wanted to go to that. Like, they never came to crew games, but they wanted to see David Beckham play. So I had said something about this when Gino was in the store, and he was like, oh, I'll get you tickets. They'll be able to sit, you know, where the player tickets are, which are in the nice seats. And, you know, we were sitting in the Nordic at the time, but these girls didn't care about that. They wanted to be as close to David Beckham as possible. So,
of course.
Yeah. But so I had to meet him to get the tickets before the game. We had obviously not coordinated well, and we went, so I'm waiting by the like player entrance gate, which is where he told me to be. And while I'm waiting, like, the Galaxy bus comes up and this security guy comes running over, and he's like, hey, you gotta go. And I was like, I'm waiting for one of the crew players. He's got tickets for me. And he's like, well, you gotta back up. He's like, you know, go stand. And he just like point. And I was like, you know, why is this such a crazy deal? And then I realized that David Beckham was on that bus, and they wanted to make sure that people weren't just like congregating to watch him get out. So I back up or whatever. And I don't think the security guy believed me at all. But yeah, it was cool. You know, they got off the bus, and that was as close as I ever was to David Beckham. But, and then, so this, the guy's like standing there, and I walk back over to the gate, and Gino would finally text me back. I assume he was, you know, getting ready or whatever. And was like, my wife's going to come bring the tickets out. And so she eventually does, but the security guy had been standing there like eyeballing me while talking to somebody else. So it was nice gratification when his wife walked out and handed me tickets, but that was a very cool experience. The kind of the David Beckham, you know, phenomenon right there. Like, you got to move. It's like, yep. I'm literally not here for that. But,
and Gino proceeded to shut David Beckham down for 90 minutes.
He did. It was, you know, Gino played well for the crew, but that was one of the more impressive games he played, at least defensively.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, this was our first run of this. I think it went pretty well. I think we'll evolve this for however long we need to go. And, you know, people can obviously send questions, and we'll tweet out stuff for various guests and for us. And if there's ever anything you wanted to know about what we do or how stuff works kind of behind the scenes, we'll be happy to answer that. We're kind of, you know, weighing this basically, because it's not what we normally do when we do this podcast, but we figure at the very least, this gives crew fans something to listen to that's a little different and isn't us all talking about how we're bored at home because of the coronavirus. So, right. Yeah, like I said, I think it went well. The plan is to still do a show a week, depending on how things go. You know, if we have enough guests that want to come on sooner rather than later, maybe we release more. We'll see. We're going to try and get Patrick Goldan next week because I think that'll be another interesting person. He's got quite a few stories, and I'm sure that'll spark your story, Sam, and you know, maybe even some of my own. And we'll have plenty to talk about as we continue to do this. But we want to thank you guys for listening. I hope everyone's staying safe, staying healthy, you know, washing your hands and practicing the social distancing that clearly we're doing because we're not at Point Tavern. So right. We'll be back next week. If you have any feedback on this show, if you think of any ideas we could do, stuff we could do better, let us know. We're always willing to take that constructive criticism. So thank you guys for listening. Sam, this was fun. I'm glad we did it.
Yep, me too.
Yeah. And we'll be back next week, and we'll get Patrick on here and see what he has to say about his time as both a crew fan, soccer fan, and massive report fashion expert, he likes to call himself, I think, though yes. Some may disagree. But yeah, we'll have fun with it next week, I'm sure. But thanks, guys, and we'll talk to you guys next week.